You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 10th to the 16th of September 2015. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter David Matthews, news editor Simon Baker and deputy news editor John Morgan. Could 7 research councils be merged into one as the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills aims to become sharper, smaller and cheaper? John Morgan has more on that in a second. Plus, he reports back from the University's UK conference, where University's Minister Joe Johnson went into some detail about his HE plans. Our cover feature this week sees David reporting from Hong Kong on scholars who believe academic freedom and institutional autonomy is under threat. He's also been blogging for us about a year he spent in Shanghai at university out there. And walking for thinking, how walking at the right pace might be the key to easing your writer's block, getting those creative juices flowing. But first, John, lead news story this week looks at the research councils. There could be a merger on the cards.
This all relates to the spending review, which is to be published on the 25th of November, but there was a deadline that passed last week for sort of stakeholders, to use the dreaded phrase, to make representations to the Treasury about what they think should happen in the spending review.
Interested parties, is
that how that's supposed to be? That's better. And what BIS has been asked to do is to model 25% and 40% cuts to its budget for the period up to 2019-20. So on a budget of roughly £13 billion, that's going to be some serious cuts. And Sajid Javid, the business secretary, has asked management consultants McKinsey to carry out a review of all BIS-funded bodies as part of the process of preparing for the spending review. And it appears that McKinsey has been looking at the idea of whether we need the existing 7 research councils, or whether we could do with just the one, perhaps. And there's also an idea, sort of related idea in the air, that they could be brought into the department directly, rather than being arm's length bodies. But that would raise all kinds of fears among researchers about threats to the Haldane principle and a government role in funding decisions. But you know, it's certainly accurate to say that the way one McKinsey partner has described BIS's thinking in the review, they're saying that BIS wants a sharper, smaller, cheaper department, and it appears a lot of radical options are being looked at by the McKinsey review, which you'd expect given the size of the cuts. And there's even suggestion from quite a lot of people in the sector that the idea of scrapping Hefke has been considered by McKinsey, which would be a radical step.
Emerging the councils, I mean, what you gain in efficiency, do you lose in expertise? What sort of response have you heard to those proposals?
But the response from Julia Goodfellow, who's the new UK president and herself a former Research Council chief executive, she was saying that the research councils are extremely efficient at present, and you'd have to ask the question, are they doing anything wrong in terms of the quality of British research, which by any measure the UK is punching above its weight, and in citation indices its research scores extremely well. So are they doing anything wrong on the quality of research? Is this just purely about that modelling of the 25% and 40% cuts that the BIS is having to go through?
I should say I call them proposals there. They're not obviously proposals, they are suggestions. These are things that we know are being discussed. David?
Is there a sense here, I remember the last spending review when this happened, there's a sense here that all of these ideas, very radical ideas for merging the councils, 40% cuts, all this kind of, the purpose is to kind of terrify everyone. So when the cuts are only 10% and you end up with 3 research councils, everyone thinks, wow, weren't we lucky? Whereas in fact, those are incredibly serious cuts. I mean, Willetts had sort of flat cash research settlement in the last 5 years, which is a sort of 10% cut, and everyone thought he was the greatest science minister who's ever lived. So it's sort of, it's a sort of PR exercise.
I know what you're saying. I mean, it's definitely, there's definitely an aspect of that to it. And the kind of elephant in the room is the flat cash settlement from last time. What's going to happen to that? Because, I mean, if you just said, oh, yeah, we're going to freeze it again, aren't we wonderful? It's well, you're freezing it at 2010 levels. I mean, it's starting to look like a huge cut, really. It already is. So, yeah, that... Maybe a lot of this discussion is masking what's going on there. I don't know.
Indeed. We'll follow it closely. Before we move on, John, you were at the UK conference earlier today as we're recording this. Joe Johnson was speaking. We've not heard too much from him so far, but this was quite an in-depth speech.
Yeah, there was a lot of policy in his speech. It was sort of broad. One of the key focuses was the teaching excellence framework. And he made some remarks that were trailed in the media beforehand about the quality of some university teaching being lamentable, and those comments went down quite badly with the audience of vice chancellors. It would be fair to say, sort of heard it described as unfair, over-egged, and out of date, and those criticisms of university teaching by some in the audience. So that's kind of a difficult point in relations with the sector. But Joe Johnson was also talking about the other things that will be in the green paper that will outline the TEF, and the green paper is going to be coming later this autumn. And it's fair to say, after hearing the speech, we know that the green paper is going to go a lot further. It's going to be about bringing in more private providers so they can get degree awarding powers and university title faster to compete with universities. He also talked about, you know, simplifying the system for research funding as part of the spending review process. Well, we can certainly interpret that it's going to be part of the spending review process. So broadly, it looks like this green paper is going to lead to a whole lot of regulatory changes, and so we could probably expect that there's going to be a higher education bill coming out of it, because it's going to be about a lot more than just the TEF.
Interesting stuff. You'll be able to follow the news from those announcements by the university's minister on timeshighereducation.co.uk. We've also got a blog from Martin Paul Eve from Birkbeck on our blog section. Moving on though now to this week's cover feature in the magazine. David, you've spent a year over in China. I think we've mentioned that. You've certainly blogged about it for us on our site. And our cover feature this week sees you reporting from Hong Kong on some concerns, I think it's fair to say, about academic freedom and institutional autonomy.
Yes, on my long journey back to the UK from China, I went via Hong Kong to do this feature. And as I'm sure listeners will know, last year saw very large protests in Hong Kong from the autumn, for about 3 months until December, basically against plans by Beijing to effectively vet candidates for the chief executive elections, which would be held in a few years. Anyway, the city is very politically polarised, and academics feel that they're often bearing the brunt of attacks by pro-Beijing forces in a variety of ways for being how they describe as politically incorrect, which basically means saying something that Beijing disapproves of, be it around Tibet or Taiwan, or questioning the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party and so on. And so I've spoken to quite a few scholars there who, the sort of general direction of attack is often the very prominent scholars who are working in the pro-democracy movement will be attacked by pro-Beijing newspapers. You know, so one guy I spoke to, Joseph Chung, he is very active in the pro-democracy movement, and he was kind of repeatedly attacked by, you know, in very, very strong terms by two pro-Beijing newspapers over the course of a week. And other people also say that the atmosphere in classrooms in Hong Kong universities is also deteriorating. You know, it's harder and harder to criticise China towards mainland students, who are a very, very large proportion of students in Hong Kong universities as you'd expect.
Mm-hmm. This is despite academic freedom on paper being enshrined in the law.
On the mainland, I mean, you know, there isn't this freedom to speak out as you'd expect. But in Hong Kong, it is enshrined by law. And when it was handed over from the UK to China, you know, there's pretty strong protections on paper regarding freedom of speech and academic and university autonomy. But people believe this is being eroded. I mean, one of the weird things I did discover when researching this piece is about Hong Kong University councils, who generally appoint and approve, you know, the senior management of universities. And the chief executive of Hong Kong, Tsai Lung, who is who is seen as very pro-Beijing, is actually constitutionally the chancellor of every university in Hong Kong. And he often has real huge powers to appoint lots of supporters to the councils, which is it's a kind of weird difference to the UK. You know, there's actually very strong government control in theory over these councils in Hong Kong. Now, you could kind of argue that these scholars who do get attacked in the press, you know, well, they are political figures, mm-hmm. Perhaps pro-Beijing newspapers have a right to respond to them. But they believe that, you know, these attacks are coordinated. Sometimes, you know, the guy, Joseph Chung, the guy I interviewed, you know, you have people coming to his house, demand the university investigate accusations of plagiarism. You know, you have threatening phone calls and so on. So generally, I found the atmosphere there is getting much chillier if you want to speak out, really, and not toe a very pro-Beijing line.
Indeed. A fascinating piece starts on page 32 this week, also on line 2. I mentioned you'd spent a year in Shanghai. I'll leave it to people to head along to our blog section where they will find some of your reflections on that year. They'll find them there. Finally, before we go, Simon, another news story this week entitled "A Stroller Day Keeps Problems at Bay." I think most of us would say, you know, if you're in need of a bit of inspiration, a good long walk can often sort that out. But someone's taken the time to look into this into some detail, and it could have some benefits for academics.
Yeah, well, it's often considered what is the best way to come up with an eye, especially if you're struggling for ideas. What's the best way to kind of take yourself away from the current situation to kind of refresh your mind in some way? It turns out that walking is a very good way of doing this, because a researcher, Norwegian School of Sports Sciences, has looked into this and sort of found by interviewing people that there's a specific speed of walking that you need to be doing that can actually help stimulate
grey matter.
Yeah, without overtaxing overtaxing your body. It's between 3 and 4 miles an hour, which does strike me as the normal pace of walking anyway. But Mia Kananen, if that's how you pronounce it, I should add, sort of found that kind of aerobic activity such as moderate walking sort of helps increase blood flow, neurotransmitter activity, decrease stress hormones, all of which can be beneficial for cognition. There's kind of evidence as well. I mean, that those may seem like kind of common sense kind of findings in a way, I suppose, that doing a bit of exercise might help. But that sort of simple repetitive movement can help to focus attention in a world that's always becoming characterized by multitasking and distractions. But it's also about kind of using the associating place with your ideas and objects and the environment with your ideas as well, I think, and that kind of helps in problem solving. So a lot of people will probably find this as something that they've discovered long ago, as it's quite obvious, but here's some actual research which has pinpointed why walking for thinking is the way forward if you're stuck.
I don't think this made it into the piece, but I think the researcher, Chris, our colleague, interviewed, I think once she walked for 6 hours in a day while working on that.
That's what you're saying, yeah.
I should say, but it was certainly that's what I understood.
Was she walking during the interview with Chris?
Who knows? We should find out. Yeah, treadmills. Get ready for sales of treadmills to go through the ceiling as universities across the UK invest. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. Thanks for listening. If you want to comment on any of the stories we've discussed, or indeed any of the articles in the magazine or online, you can do so at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn as well. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.